Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Eddie Tabash, a board member of the Center for Inquiry, and I want to welcome you to this most important event tonight. Whether you are a believer or a non-believer, in many ways, given the prevailing attitudes in the world, there cannot be a more important question to answer than, does God exist? And tonight, we are putting on a full-blown debate on that very topic. And I want to introduce our debaters, and then I'm going to explain what the format will be. We also ask that during the debate there be no shouting out or interruption, and that everybody, regardless of the side they're on, exercise a bit of discipline, because our debaters need to focus and concentrate on this really, really topic of cosmic, literally, significance. At the Center for Inquiry, we pride ourselves in bringing in, periodically, the opposing viewpoint. So it's a great privilege for me to present someone whom I have debated, one of the very distinguished religious philosophers in the United States today, a professor of philosophy at the Talbot School of Theology at Biola University in La Mirada, California, the publisher of many books and articles, gentleman with a PhD in philosophy from the University of Southern California, and our guest this evening, please welcome Professor R. Douglas Guyvett. And arguing that God does not exist will be our own John Shook, who is the Vice President of Education for the Center for Inquiry and runs our Naturalism Project. Dr. Shook was a professor of philosophy at the Oklahoma State University for 6 years. He is local to the Buffalo area and obtained his PhD in philosophy literally across the street at SUNY Buffalo. He is also the author of forthcoming books and the author of many, many articles where he defends the naturalistic point of view. For those of you who are regulars at CFI, he is no stranger. So please welcome on the debate platform tonight, Dr. John Shook. The format will be each debater has a 20-minute opening statement. Each has a 10-minute response. Then each has another 5-minute response. In the question and answers, each debater will have 2 minutes to answer each question, regardless of to whom addressed. And we want to make sure that if you ask a question, you line up behind the microphone in the middle of the room, so that we can record your question as well as the answer. And with that, we will begin the debate on this most important question facing humanity: does God exist? Thank you all for attending.
Well, we all know why we're here tonight, don't we? Someone in the audience might be thinking, well, I can tell you why I'm here tonight. I'm here to see them feed the Christian theist to the atheist client. That's why I took out a generous life insurance policy a few days ago, provided for my family. Well, I'm kidding, of course. I've enjoyed the warm hospitality of all those involved in organizing this event. John Shook, who was the one who first invited me to be here, thank you. Courtney Haney, who was greeting people on the way in, has been helping me with arrangements to get from California to here. And I thank her for her fantastic help with that and all the exciting paperwork. Courtney, thank you. And, of course, my friend Eddie Tabash for being here to moderate. I was pleased to hear that he would be the one. I've met others who are involved. And then Derek, who was helping to set up. I had dinner with Tom Flynn, who was working with cameras. And I met Lauren just moments ago, who was doing the most important work of keeping us on schedule. Thank you all. Speaking of warm hospitality, it's hard for this Californian to continue thinking of Buffalo as the blizzard capital of the United States. There's about a one or two difference in degree in temperature between here in Buffalo and my home in Orange County, California. I suppose I need to stick around for about 3 months to be sure that there really are differences between our areas. But we're not here to talk about the weather. We're here for a debate. Our debate is about the comparative rationality of two different worldviews, mine and John Shook's. I'm the guy who believes in God. That makes me a theist. A theist. And I'll be presenting evidence in support of theism. Now here's what I mean by theism. Need a definition for starters? This is my definition for tonight. Theism is the view that there is a timeless, immaterial, personal being of great power and intelligence who created the universe and sustains it in existence. For short, I will call this being God. This is my position. Now, let me ask a question of the audience. Are there any here tonight who also believe in God? Okay, a smattering of people have come. Thank you for coming, and please don't leave. So my worldview is theism. What is John Shook's worldview when he was introduced? Eddie mentioned that his view is naturalism. He is a scientific naturalist in that he places special emphasis on the role of science in knowing the things we know. On his view, we need a more or less scientific explanation for anything that we're entitled to believe. Now here's how he defines his own worldview, these are his words. Naturalism is a philosophy that says that the results of experience, reason, and science together tell us everything we need to know about reality. No further beliefs about the supernatural or the paranormal are justified or needed for a complete worldview of reality. Elsewhere, he says, again quoting more briefly, naturalism is usually identified, defined most briefly as the philosophical conclusion that the only reality is nature, as gradually discovered by our intelligence using the tools of experience, reason, and science. So, we are comparing these two worldviews, theism and naturalism, defined in these ways. There are other worldviews, polytheism, pantheism, deism, something exotic called panentheism, but these will have to be discussed another time, perhaps by people who represent these views. Tonight our discussion is limited to our own two perspectives. Now how do you decide, when confronted with two alternatives, which worldview makes the most sense? How do you compare them? Well, first, think about the nature of a worldview. A worldview is a comprehensive view of reality, beginning with the most fundamental questions concerning human existence. Though worldviews differ, and they differ radically, they differ in how they answer the same questions. Questions like, why is there a universe? Why this universe and not some other universe? What does it mean to be human? What is the nature of moral responsibility? Do humans have the capacity of self-determination? Do they have free will? What about pain and suffering? What do they mean? Do they mean anything? Are they gratuitous? Now we ask these questions for a lot of reasons, but two important reasons especially. First, these questions are generated by deeply puzzling phenomena that we observe in the world in which we live. And second, these questions are existentially significant. They make a difference to how we view ourselves and to how we live our lives. This is a fundamentally humanistic concern, whatever your worldview happens to be. In order to compare theism and naturalism, we have then to consider the phenomena behind the questions. We should observe and describe these phenomena carefully, and then we need to ask this question. What is the best explanation for what we find? Or, in this case, which explanation the one offered by John Shook, naturalism, or my own explanation, the theistic hypothesis, makes the most sense in explaining these phenomena. Now, theism offers one kind of explanation. Scientific naturalism offers another kind of explanation. And I believe that the God hypothesis is actually more reasonable than naturalism. So let me turn to the first and most basic puzzle of human existence, the origin of the universe. Now, we find ourselves in a universe that apparently exploded into existence some 12, 13, 15, or possibly 20 billion years ago. This is the scientific consensus. We have empirical evidence for this sort of thing. And while there are scientists who are busy considering alternatives, the big bang cosmology is the main consensus. We have empirical evidence that the universe had a beginning. Of course, it began a long time ago, billions and billions of years ago, but still a finite time ago. And that means that there was a first event in the history of the universe. Now, we know of no events that occur without having causes. There is a zero probability based on empirical observation that any event has occurred without a cause. The origin of the universe, the coming to be of the universe, the Big Bang singularity, the first event in the history of the universe, must then have a cause. When something begins to exist, as a cause. But clearly in this case, the cause of the beginning of the universe cannot be an event within the universe. The cause must be transcendent. Because space and time were themselves compacted into the Big Bang singularity, both space and time themselves began to exist in the Big Bang. So the cause is transcendent, timeless and immaterial, yet capable of producing a universe of physical stuff out of nothing. If the cause is not an antecedent event, then it is a personal agent, and of course, it is a remarkably intelligent and powerful agent. We see then that a theistic hypothesis, one like I described when I defined theism, provides a powerful explanation for the origin of the universe. John Shook, as a naturalist, will have to offer a naturalistic explanation. And not only that, demonstrate that his explanation is better than the theistic explanation if he is to have a better alternative. The next item on the list of phenomena that are deeply puzzling are all in the category of apparent design. Now notice I've chosen my terminology carefully so I'm not begging any questions here. I use the phrase apparent design. And that's because naturalists, atheists, various varieties, as well as theists of various varieties, all agree that there at least appears to be design in the universe. Richard Dawkins, for example, in his book, The God of Illusion, says this out in the open. Yes, there does appear to be design. Now, of course, if there is design, then there is a designer. And that's the conclusion that he rejects. And so he tries to explain the appearance of design in some way that entails that what appears to be design is not actually design. Okay? But the phenomena are the same for all of us, for John Shook as well as for me, and that is apparent design. Among the things that give us the appearance of design are what are called cosmic constants. These are the most fundamental laws that govern the behavior of the physical universe, especially at both the macroscopic, magnoscopic, and microscopic level. These concern the strong force, the weak force, the force of gravity, and various other values that are given to the laws that govern how things will run in the physical universe of the stars, so that over time, it takes it has the appearance that it has today. And most importantly, sustain life, at least in one solar system, on one planet, meaning the Earth. We know that because here we are. Now we also know that if you were to take any one of these cosmic constants and adjust the values at all, then you would skew things in such a way as to prevent development of the universe that would be friendly to any kind of organic or biological system, including ourselves. On top of that, things are magnified and hence complexified by the fact that this is true for all the variables. So if you start tinkering with not only one, but the next one and then the next one on your dials, either raising or lowering the values for their actual function in guiding the behavior of objects in the universe, things are going to be radically different. So it doesn't take very much for them to go off the trail from where we've come to reach a place where life as our own exists. Now this has impressed scientists as very human-friendly and has yielded up a principle called the anthropic principle because it entails that human beings would not exist but for these values being what they are. One illustration is the rate of the expansion of the universe. Big bangs, as well as small bangs, happen at varying degrees of intensity. The Big Bang, happened at a great degree of intensity, but it could have been greater. Had it been greater, then things would have expanded away from the center of the explosion at a much greater rate. And there wouldn't have been time for galaxies, planets, stars, and the like of that to form, and so no solar system, no human planet, no humanity, no organic life. On the other hand, if the force of the explosion was less intense than what it was, then the universe, such as it would be then, would spread out to a certain point, and then before it had time to form the elements and the planets and stars, it would collapse back onto itself. So it seems then that the universe is fine-tuned for life. It is incredible against the odds that there would be a universe such as ours if it wasn't for some purpose that had to do with the production of human beings, conscious, capable of understanding these things, and considering what might be the best explanation. So, that's one aspect of apparent design that I believe is much better explained by theism than by naturalism. We have the origin of the universe, which gives us this kind of creator, and now we have design, which would explain it, that our Creator also intended the production of human beings. There's a nice conjunction there as well. The third category of puzzling evidence comes in the category of moral responsibility. And here there are actually four different evidences. So with this one, I end up with six on top of the first two, right? These four will make six things to explain. Within the physical universe, among the things we find are ourselves. And one of the most distinctive things about ourselves is our sense of moral responsibility or accountability. This is another puzzling phenomenon. But really there are four puzzles suggested or nested within this general problem. Consider first the existence of abstract moral . These are transcendent, immaterial, causally inert principles with moral content that have imperatival force, which, as it happens, cannot be enforced by themselves. What explains these entities? Well, that was a lot to say in one sentence. They're abstract. They're not concrete. They're not empirically verifiable. You can't detect them using the senses. There's no scientific means of even knowing that they're there, much less knowing what they are. And these moral principles are stipulated. They indicate what is imperative in the form of behavior. And yet they cannot cause entities to exist that would be morally significant agents, and they can't cause morally significant agents to have a conscience or feel guilty or feel good. They have no causal power whatsoever, and they're just there. Well, what explains their existence? Second, we have the contingent existence of morally responsible agents. Not principles only, but people like ourselves, who actually behave morally. We do things that are good and that are bad. We do things that are right, morally, and that are wrong moral. We have a conscience. We seem to know what the content of morality includes, at least in some cases we actually agree pretty much on what things are. But why are there contingently existing personal agents in a physical universe that is not causally linked at all to these abstract moral principles? What a coincidence that is. Why should there be a universe that would just happen to turn up agents that come under the imperatifiable force of causally inert abstract objects? That's another problem. A third problem here is that we know the content of moral principles. And the question is, how do we know them? We don't know them scientifically. It seems then that we are endowed with a special faculty of moral awareness, moral intuition, that will enable us to know the content of morality and know that when we're guilty, we should feel guilty, and that sometimes when we feel guilty, we are guilty. But where does this faculty come from? It's not turned up in any naturalistic way by physics or chemistry. And it seems purely accidental on such a naturalistic worldview. The fourth aspect of human freedom that creates problems for all of our worldviews is freedom of the will, without which there would be no such thing as moral responsibility. Why punish someone if he can't help doing what he does? You don't hold somebody morally responsible if he's not free. So we have to be free in order to act morally. Now, how do you account for freedom if you're a naturalist? Especially if you think that everything about our physical universe follows necessarily from antecedent physical states in accordance with the laws of nature. It seems then that everything that happens, including what seems like freedom, would not be free, but ultimately determined. Now, you can see the problems for naturalism here because I've noted them for you. How does theism solve the problems? Well, theism helps us see that these principles are not just abstract entities that aren't linked to anything else that's transcendent. They're linked to something else that's transcendent, namely a personal God. Second, it is the personal God who creates the contingent entities such as ourselves capable of moral behavior. Third, he endows us with the faculty to know the content of morality. And he endows us with freedom of will so that he can hold us responsible when we do what's wrong, or we can hold each other responsible. Now, these are various reasons to think that there is a God. These are reasons to support the theistic hypothesis. But this hypothesis now has to be compared with the naturalistic hypothesis. That is to say, these same basic questions arise for John Schuch's worldview. We now stand, or sit, and wait to hear his explanation as to how naturalism can solve this problem.
Good evening. My thanks also go to Doug for coming and accepting my invitation so graciously. It's a wonderful delight to have you here, and I hope you find the experience as enjoyable as I am. Thanks to also the people who have helped me out, especially Courtney Haney and Ake Eisenhower with organizing the Summer Institute, and our marvelous CFI staff who are helping filming the event tonight. My opening remarks are going to cover some general major arguments typically found in this debate over whether or not God probably or probably does not exist. I'm going to have the opportunity to address some specific points, very fascinating points, that Doug raises in his opening in my rebuttal. So the format is we each have prepared general opening remarks, sort of setting the stage, giving you folks a lay of the land and where the respective camps are, and then we'll each have opportunity for a series of rebuttals where we reply to some specific points and really get into the meat of the argument. So I'm going to plunge ahead and talk about where I'm coming from. My role in this debate is to explain how to be skeptical towards God. If you don't understand how to be skeptical, you won't be able to follow a debate like this. I simply don't believe in mythical creatures. There are nowhere near enough good reasons to think they exist. For example, there's been a lot of talk lately about a certain mythical creature. I'm skeptical It's a strange creature that has a special superpower, the ability to know everything that exists and doesn't exist. People keep talking about this creature, the new atheist. Maybe you've heard of this new atheist. Lately, when I hear stories of the new atheist, it's someone who absolutely knows with complete certainty that no God can possibly exist. An amusing creature, this dogmatic, overconfident atheist. As the stories go, and maybe you've heard one of these tall tales, the people are given a simple choice. Either the new atheist is right, or he's wrong and God exists. A silly choice, really, having to choose between these two super intelligent know-it-alls. With such tall tales going around, no longer lots of people, no wonder lots of people get confused about how debating works. No fairy tales tonight, though. We're going to take a hard look at the evidence, as Doug has already said, and try to decide whether God makes a good fit with this evidence. You can call me a skeptical atheist, as opposed to a dogmatic atheist, or just a skeptic for short. It's not reasonable to think that God probably exists. It's far more likely that no God exists. The problem with the God hypothesis is that it really doesn't respect the rationality of the mind, and it really doesn't square with the total amount of available evidence. So let's get into some specific arguments. My lineup is very similar to Doug. Theologians and atheists have been doing this for a while, so we kind of agree on what most of the major points are, so it's not surprising to have some convergence already, so let's get into it. Let's start talking about the biggest piece of evidence that we know about, the entire visible universe. Our question is whether or not a supernatural God is a good explanation for our universe. Now, we can begin with a simple choice. Either there's nothing beyond this visible universe, or something beyond it does exist. We can see how the theologian thinks that there's something beyond our visible universe, and he thinks it should be called God. Actually, there probably is lots more natural universe out there beyond our visible universe. I don't think a theologian wants to call that extra nature God, though. In fact, the science of cosmology, which tries to understand the universe and the Big Bang, actually expects that there's probably lots more hidden universe that also exploded out of the same Big Bang, but we can't see it since it exploded off so fast in other directions that light from it will never, in fact, reach us. There's a visible universe, and then there's the total universe, and in fact, some cosmologists suggest that we are but 1/1,000,000th our visible universe of everything that came out of this Big Bang. All I'm saying is we have to be careful when we start talking about things that are beyond the universe. Which universe do you mean? The notion that there is a God beyond the universe seems reasonable if you already think that whatever caused the Big Bang is supernatural. But technically, such a cause would simply be superuniversal, since it came before our universe. But that doesn't automatically make it supernatural in any religious sense. Whatever caused the Big Bang, for example, could be natural instead. And for all we know, this extra nature might not have had a beginning itself. In other words, the hypothesis that a God must have been responsible for creating the universe and the Big Bang first requires knowing that it could have not been created by more nature behind and before our universe. We're into a little bit of a burden of proof. The problem is, however, that the amount of available evidence is actually relatively small. Now, we're talking about the visible universe, and that's big. But I think what we reach here is a sort of skeptical standoff. I can't prove that there is more nature. He can't prove that there isn't. Science, of course, respects the rational principle that whatever had a beginning must have had a cause. And in fact, cosmologists are very busy trying to postulate what may have been around at the time of the Big Bang in order to cause it. Now, theologians don't like this notion of postulating more nature, much less more eternal nature, that possibly existed before our universe in order to cause our universe. It's not science's job, really, to now declare that this has been proven. It has not been proven. We're in a region of philosophical and theological speculation. There is one argument commonly found today in arguments. Doug briefly sort of directly pointed at it. The notion that nature must have had a beginning. If you don't like calling it the Big Bang, if there was something before that, that must have had a beginning. There's this notion out there that whatever is natural must have had a beginning. And sometimes it uses the concept of infinity. The typical version of the argument goes, well, you know, if there really was this eternal nature, then you're asking us to believe in sort of, you know, an infinite amount of time that has passed until now, but no one can conceive of such a completed infinite series of events, so we have to throw out that hypothesis. Nature must have had a beginning. The problem with this argument is that it asks us to imagine a completed infinity. And that, of course, misuses the concept of infinity, because if you're actually succeeding in imagining a completed infinity, you're not imagining infinity. Infinity is that which cannot be completed. So the argument again results in a skeptical stalemate. Yes, the human mind boggles at infinities. Well, you know, the theologian's been offering us an infinite God for a while. My mind boggles at that too. So I think we have a sort of mutual mind-boggling skeptical standoff. And again, that supports my preference that, so far as we know, only nature exists. And for all we know, more nature exists before the Big Bang, and the theologian cannot come up with an argument to prove that that cannot be the case. Moving on to another argument, the fine-tuning argument. It's an up-to-date version of the old design argument for God. Whatever is intriguingly ordered and complex requires an intelligent designer. Some points have been mentioned by Doug about how certain physical constants and laws appear to be fine-tuned, and there is that appearance. We can agree on that. The problem is deciding exactly how important this is. You have to remember, though, while it's interesting that theology here is dependent upon science for its facts, and I wish that always were the case, while it is interesting that science is dependent on providing the facts upon which to build a theology, you have to remember that science, unlike religion, frequently is forced to revise and extend and alter its theories about, well, things at the cutting edge, like the Big Bang. One of the problems with this fine-tuning argument is that it's so precariously based on current scientific knowledge of the laws of nature involved with the Big Bang, and I think we can expect scientific progress to change this understanding in a way that may not be as favorable to a theological argument here as we might have supposed. There's been much talk lately, for example, about the fine-tuned cosmological constant, perfectly balancing the vacuum energy density, permitting the universe to expand big enough to permit stars and planets and the sorts of things that we think are necessary for the existence of life in our universe. The problem, however, is that it might be the case that the universe's vacuum energy density is really a phenomenon caused or created by some other basic feature of the universe that we don't understand well. We're starting to see things like dark energy and dark matter appear. Quantum mechanics and quantum cosmology is altering our understanding of the Big Bang. This coincidence of fine-tuning the cosmological constant may disappear. It may turn out to, in fact, be a necessary feature of any universe that explodes in anything like the Big Bang. You also have to watch out for exaggerated probabilities, extreme chance-like things that happen that really only look very chancy because of the units of measurement that have been selected. Let me give you an example. Michael Jordan was a great basketball player. If he had only been one part in 10 to the 16th of a light year shorter, he would not have been so great a basketball player. Michael Jordan, caused by God. Well, the problem is that one part in 10 to the 16th of a light year is about a meter. Yeah, if Michael Jordan had only been 4 feet tall, he wouldn't have been so great a basketball player. But now the miracle has evaporated. It was just created by an arbitrary choice of unit of measurement. There are some intriguing constants that aren't just dissolvable by unit of measurement, but scientists there are recently discovering that some of these examples of incredible fine-tuning aren't so incredible. In fact, there may be as much as 15 to 20% wiggle room in the relative strengths of certain forces of nature, masses of subatomic particles, that could still permit the existence of stars and planets. Furthermore, we can't be sure that the universe really is designed for life like ours. In fact, as Carl Sagan once said, if the universe seems designed for anything, it's sand. The universe is vast. Opportunities for habitable opportunities for life to emerge are small. Once upon a time, the only planet we knew was Earth. It seemed uniquely special. Hey, we must be special. We don't look so special in the universe anymore. Life doesn't look so special in the universe anymore. I've already mentioned to you how the visible universe is one tiny corner of all the universe that emerged out of the Big Bang. Science may discover evidence that suggests other universes beyond our own that may have different basic laws as well. It's starting to look as if it's possible. And again, I'm not claiming that science knows this or naturalism depends on it. I'm looking for my skeptical standoff again. As far as we know, we may just happen to live in a lucky corner of the universe, much in the way as now we see we live on a lucky planet lost among countless other planets. Don't count science out. Science tends to give perspective on things that eliminates the need for a God hypothesis. All right, moving on to the next point. I want to talk a little bit about the problem of evil, which is a variation on this business of fine-tuning. Some theologians try to prove that God exists by saying what a wonderful world this is. It's a bit hazardous because if the theologian is trying to point to the design in order to prove a very good designer, a designer that cares enough about us to want to create us, the sort of God that I think Doug Guyvette is talking about, you have to remember that if God designed the whole enchilada, if God designed everything in this universe and intended it to be the way it is, any fault, any imperfection, any mistake in the design, anything like a natural defect, or we might call it even an evil, counts as a piece of evidence against the existence of such a great God. Now, maybe God's not so great. I'll leave that for Doug to debate with other religious believers. As for this skeptical atheist, I can point to thousands of examples of what seem to be unnecessary natural evils. We live, from the perspective of life, in an imperfect universe. Theologians have spent hundreds of years trying to figure out how such a nice God would make such a wasteful and unpleasant universe. Now, theology isn't imaginative enough to come up with elaborate stories about God, and different religions disagree on such stories, just like they disagree about everything else. One says God wants lots of people to reject God for lack of evidence, so hell is full. Another says God wants all people to eventually resort to faith for lack of evidence, so that heaven is full. Endless variations on such stories are told and retold. You can almost convince yourself that a great God would create just this actual world that we live in. Maybe this nice God wants us to live short and hard lives with quickly failing bodies and slowly working minds. But I repeat this point. A theologian must, if they're going to make this argument work, that we live in such a great design that it points to a really great guy upstairs, a theologian must defend everything about the universe as something God wanted and intended. If there's anything in the world that God would not want, that evidence counts heavily against God's existence. There are so many things that humans cannot understand is really good when they look so evil to us. Now, there's a temptation for the theologian here to say, well, even though things appear to be evil, these hurricanes and diseases and floods, I leave out evils that people do to each other. Maybe free will accounts for this. I'm not so worried about human morality at this point. That's my next discussion point. Rather, I'm worried about natural evils. Did this universe have to be so tough and hard, and our lives so miserable? How much evil counts against God? My argument is there's plenty of evil that we already know of right now that counts against such a great God's existence. But I'm interested in pursuing this a little bit further. For example, Doug replies that, yeah, there's some things that look like evil, but there's not that much evil, and the God hypothesis is still in deep trouble. And we can wonder, how much evil would it take for him or any religious person to start to doubt God? If there's no amount of evil, not even a million plagues and earthquakes and holocausts, then that would make any theologian, seem to be in a precarious position. Why wouldn't they start doubting at that point? If they still wouldn't start doubting, then all this talk about the evidence letting decide God's existence is actually a complete waste of time. We're really not arguing the evidence anymore. Faith is probably involved here. The skeptic, to repeat, is already confident that there's plenty of evil evidence to cast lots of doubt on a great God, and if Doug thinks otherwise, I invite him to show that all of these natural evils are actually necessarily required in God's great plan. I have another dilemma that I have to briefly mention. Even if the theologian somehow manages to succeed in persuading himself and others that evils are actually good, how are we to continue to know the difference between evil and good? Last I checked, religion loves to lord it over non-believers that only the religious know the difference between evil and good and can really justify it and be sure. But if a theologian can make every apparent evil actually good, I think we would begin to lose the ability to truly know the difference between evil and good. Is from God's perspective everything really good? If so, should the religious believer adopt God's perspective? Presumably. But again, I think the difference between good and evil is jeopardized. I, however, as a naturalist, I have no temptation to view this universe as an ideal habitat for us. I'm not tempted to lose the distinction between good and evil. Naturalism has a much simpler explanation for all of the evidence, both good and evil. I'm going to say just a couple of things about morality. In my rebuttal, I'm going to have an opportunity to reply directly to the points that Doug has asked us to consider. They're important points, but I want to make a couple of general points. Doug has talked about these abstract moral imperatives. That's a bit of a terminology of art that can happen among philosophers and theologians. In other places, they're called objective moral truths. They're supposedly these sorts of things that we really think that we know for sure. Well, I know some of these objective moral truths, or at least I think I do until I'm informed otherwise. I think that, killing innocent people is wrong. I think that you should do unto others as they do unto you. I could compile a short list. You could help me add to it. I think they're objective. I don't think that they depend on my personal whim or will. I was taught to them by a culture. I have good reasons for believing that they're true, and I have good reasons for thinking that humanity in general is right. Your civilized people should respect them. And that's the kind of objectivity that I can offer as an explanation of how human beings can know morality. I'm confident, however, a theologian is not going to be satisfied with that sort of objectivity. The theologian is obsessed with the notion that morality can somehow change. That's why they want some moral truths to be absolute, transcendent, right? I offer an opportunity to, explain what one of these are, that are so absolute. We've not yet heard a good reason to think that they exist. Perhaps Doug is going to offer one. I'm just not impressed when religion claims that it has possession of these absolute moral truths. Religions disagree notoriously, and I'm not sure anybody can know the mind of God, if there is a God, not even a theologian, to be confident that God wouldn't change his or her mind about morality. I refer to the Old Testament, some changing of mind there, but we needn't debate Scripture. My general skeptical standoff point is, if you're looking to religion for absolute moral truths, I don't see how you're going to find them, and I don't see where a good argument is going to come from that doesn't beg the question. In conclusion, on the point of morality, the available evidence, people trying to be moral on this planet, consists of vast disagreement about morality, even among religious believers. Notoriously, we watch denominations divide and subdivide like bacteria colonies over questions of morality. If we do know some objective moral truths, I claim that naturalism can explain the available evidence without having to resort to any supernatural God. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I set a challenge for John, who is a naturalist, to explain the same range of phenomena that puzzle all of us, and to do it in a way that improves on the theistic explanation. He taught us, in effect, how to be skeptical about God, and argued that there is no need to actually prove that God does not exist. Presumably, he thinks that he cannot prove that God does not exist, and that is an honest admission. That by itself does not mean that God does exist, of course. But he does think that it's far more likely that God does not exist than it is that God does exist, and so he must have some evidence that makes it more likely, right? His evidence must make it more likely that God does not exist. It has to trump the evidence that I've presented that God does exist. So he can't just neutralize my evidence with equally powerful evidence. He's got to overcome the force of my evidence with greater, more stronger arguments. Well, what does he have to say about the visible universe? Well, the first thing he says is irrelevant. And that is that the physical universe probably includes a lot that's not visible. But notice my argument from the origin of the universe doesn't depend upon what parts are visible and what parts are invisible. It doesn't matter. If the visible part of the universe is part of a total universe that still has a beginning, the argument still works. So that was a rabbit trail, and it was irrelevant. Then he says, which universe do you mean when you talk about the universe? Well, I didn't think that was unclear. I was talking about the one universe we know to exist, the one where we happen to be just now. I don't know of any other universe that we could talk about in a meaningful way, which brings us to the next point, and that is he wants to say that there might be many universes, and this is only one, which is supposed to lower the difficulty of the probability that this universe, special among all possibilities, would exist. But before he developed that point, he talked about his strategy in terms of a skeptical standoff. This is really what he's trying to do this evening. He's trying to say, look, if your evidence doesn't convince me that God exists, then I am justified in believing that God does not exist because we are at a skeptical standoff. I should think quite differently about that. In the field of epistemology and philosophy, it's widely known that if the evidence on two sides of a question counterbalance each other, one is not more justified than the other. The only attitude that's actually justified is agnosticism. Right? And then you wouldn't be in a position to define your naturalism by claiming that nature is all that exists. You'd have to say, maybe so, maybe not. And so if we're at a skeptical standoff, he ought to be an agnostic, not an atheist, and certainly not the kind of naturalist he calls himself. Also, he says that maybe there's something natural before the beginning of the physical universe. But remember, there is no before. This is why the Creator is timeless. Time itself comes to exist with the origin of the universe. That's part of what we know or believe with justification from science. Then he talked about an argument based on being able to complete an infinite series either abstractly or in the concrete, and I think he anticipated me. I think he anticipated that I would present an argument to that effect, but I didn't, and so he answered an argument I didn't give, and so I won't defend that argument. As far as fine-tuning is concerned, he says we really ought to ask ourselves, how important is it that these values are so remarkably fine-tuned? And, okay, a handful of scientists are getting excited about the possibility of showing that these things can be altered to a greater degree than many think. But there isn't as much wiggle room as John would have you. If you say, well, there are at least a few of these where you have room with a variability of 15 to 20%, that doesn't tell you what to do with the other 95 to 80% on those values, not to mention all the other cosmic constants where you don't have that kind of wiggle room. So he hasn't demonstrated any kind of special freedom to move beyond the apparent design into a naturalistic inference. It's interesting the way he talks about science. I don't think it's very consistent. When he's commenting on how theists will refer to scientific evidence for theism, he wants to say, science, you know, they change their minds. Theories are always subject to flux, and the theories we have today will probably be history and abandoned in the future. But then he wants to tell us in other situations, you know, science is where the action is. We can know so much on the basis of science. You see, when a scientific theory seems to support his view, yay for science. But when it seems to support theism, it's like, well, you know, science is still in progress. The fact is that scientists believe what they have reason to believe during the period of time when they have the evidence for it. Later, if other evidence is forthcoming and they have to change their paradigm, then they'll change their paradigm. But today, our paradigm is a Big Bang cosmology, and there's no reason to change our paradigm until we have empirical evidence to the contrary. In fact, in something he's written, he talks about the Santa Claus mythology, the figure of Santa Claus, and says, I don't believe in Santa Claus, although it's possible that Santa Claus exists. And then he explains why he doesn't believe in Santa Claus, and he wants to say it's just like believing in God. The reason why he doesn't believe in Santa Claus is the same reason why I don't believe in Santa Claus, and that is there is zero evidence for the existence of Santa Claus. There is no analogy between the Santa Claus hypothesis and the God hypothesis, because as you can tell from tonight, there is ample evidence for the existence of God, even if you think it is outweighed by evidence for naturalism. So that won't work. What about the problem of evil? It's interesting that he mentions this as well, because you have to walk gingerly through this territory as a naturalist who believes you cannot prove that God does not exist. If you press this argument too hard, then it will entail that God does not exist. And then you've contradicted yourself when you said earlier you can't prove that God does not exist. So he presumably believes that the evils that do exist are compatible with the existence of God. Right? They have to be compatible with the existence of God on his view, because if they weren't, it would follow that God does not exist, and he'd have a proof that God does not exist. What he has instead are difficulties trying to figure out what purpose God could have for permitting the evils that God does. And he thinks that's supposed to be a reason why we should think that God does not exist. Now that strikes me as puzzling. First of all, I can well imagine what kind of world John would create if he had God's power. It would probably be a different world than this one. It would probably be different if I had God's power. But I want to ask John to answer this question when he comes up to the podium. What kind of world would he create if he was omniscient? The answer, of course, has to be, well, I don't know. Because you'd have to be omniscient to know what you would think, what you would believe, and what you would be justified in believing if you were omniscient. Finally, I want to say that there is danger on the naturalist part in bringing up the problem of evil, because he clearly believes that there is such a thing as good and evil, and yet he hasn't told us how he can explain that. I believe that evil is a departure from the way things ought to be, that this is a pretty natural view of what evil is. But how can there be a departure from the way things ought to be if there isn't a way things ought to be? And that makes direct reference to a transcendent design plan, and hence a designer. And so, let's see if he can explain why there should be evil, which he says naturalism can explain the existence of evil better than theism, but I don't think he can, given the argument that I just gave. Thank you.
I promised you an education in how to be a skeptic. We're going to get it. Doug understands little about what I've been trying to say so far. In fact, he went so far as to accuse me of contradicting myself. What I'm trying to do is construct the very best positive argument for not accepting God's existence with some fair confidence. But I'm going to tell you exactly how far the arguments go, their limitations, and how skeptical you can get on each of the arguments. Taken singly, I offered four positive arguments for disbelieving in God's existence. The first two tended to end up in what I call skeptical standoffs, where it's reasonable to disbelieve in God because we're already sure nature exists. I hope we're pretty sure at least nature exists, right? That's our body of evidence. That's called naturalism. The question of whether we should additionally add a supernatural God is the point of the debate. So when I reach a skeptical standoff, I win. I don't contradict myself. I tell you how far I can go. I think that the problem of evil and my explanation of morality gives excellent positive reasons to think that naturalism can fully explain the evidence, whereas the God hypothesis fails. These are even stronger arguments, so I don't know why this word agnosticism got thrown around. I didn't bring it up. I'm not sure if that's a useful term anymore. I am a skeptic, and I'll tell you how far the arguments can take us, and you can decide how strongly you want to disbelieve in God. I'm pretty strong in my disbelief, and I'm going to give some additional reasons why to answer Doug's specific points. The evidence is nowhere near enough to even begin to propose God. Besides, we haven't even heard from Doug any positive reasons for us to understand how a supernatural God could even create physical matter. Presumably, Doug is talking about a God that is supernatural, that is not just another natural thing. It's relatively easy for the human mind to understand causal relations between natural things. God is a mystery. We're being asked, presumably, to accept some more mysterious, miraculous causes between something that is unnatural in order to create, maybe even out of nothing. I'm not sure what story Doug could offer, but I'm sure it's going to be a mystery. We understand causal relations between things that share something in common. Now, if Doug thinks that God, the God that he wants to argue for, is partly natural or has some common features with nature, I invite him to tell us. That would indicate he's more of a pantheist. So I say he might contradict himself. But at any rate, we'll await some further reasons to think that God could even create the universe. I doubt I'll be impressed. My use of science is conservative. Doug thinks I'm pro-science here, not so happy with science. Again, this skeptic will tell you exactly how far science is going right now because I listen to the scientists. The scientists are fairly confident about some things about the universe, but at the very edges, it's the scientists who are humble and conservative and not so confident to think that they always have the final right answers. That's science's job, and this naturalist will follow that sort of conservative position. When science is speculative, I defer. Where I stop is thinking that adding a mysterious supernatural God with miraculous causal power somehow assists us in understanding the Big Bang. Doug continues to assert, without any reasons given that I've heard so far, why there couldn't be something more natural, perhaps in a new form that we're not quite clear on, new forms of energy, new laws of this extra nature. Science has done amazing things. I think to suddenly stop, want to draw a line and say, science shall go no farther, only dragons lie beyond, is foolishness, and it puts the theologian in a very difficult position. Wherever science has looked, it's only found more nature. Now, obviously, the theologian wants to, at some point, go beyond science, but I'm still awaiting some good reasons why we ought to do this. On the subject of evil, what kind of world would I create? I would create a world without Down syndrome. I would create a world without Tay-Sachs disease. I would create a world without trisomy 13. I would create a world without horrible diseases that afflict the innocent. And the reason why I would do at least that is because I believe in certain objective moral truths, like there ought not to be innocent suffering caused to the weak and to the innocent. If that's what God is doing to the weak and the innocent, I spurn that God. I have additional skeptical reasons for doubting the very existence of this God. Doug has not offered to explain why there ought to be perfectly miserable afflictions upon the weak and the innocent. When bad things happen to bad people, I understand. When bad things happen to good people, I sympathize. When bad things happen to the weak, the innocent, who cannot possibly benefit or profit or enjoy in any way the consequences of that, I rebel. My moral sense rebels, and I think you folks have that same moral sense. Doug wonders where this moral sense comes from. I claim it is through education, the same path by which we learn everything else. I was so fortunate to grow up among civilized peoples who, through long practical wisdom, has discovered that the direction of positive survival and well-being on this planet lies in human beings in cooperation with wider nature, trying to protect the weak and the innocent, trying to make sure that we leave our places of inhabitant better off than when we left it. I know we don't do this so well, but I'm a humanist. I believe in objective moral truths, and I think the general convergence of civilized people on this planet is starting to recognize that there is a global wisdom. Religions have actually long been part of these wisdom traditions. I honor and respect the humanistic aspects of all of the globe's religions, and I would only ask that we stop worrying about the atheist, who is sometimes depicted as a lunatic or a Nazi, but instead focus on humanism. I believe this is the best road forward, and I think that's all the kind of objectivity we need in order to know the difference between humanistic principles and fascist, dictatorial, or evil principles. Again, I can still tell the difference between good and evil. On this universe that supposedly a great God created, I can't tell the difference between good and evil anymore. I wonder if the theologian can. Finally, one more point. This business of chasing after transcendence. You know, that's the theologian's job. I understand why he has to do it. He thinks that there's positive evidence that requires it. When the positive evidence instead is fully inadequately and even better explained by the naturalistic hypothesis, that is full-on 100% atheism. You don't need the God hypothesis. The God hypothesis only creates more mysteries and it conflicts with the actual observed evidence. That's all the skepticism I need to be a naturalist. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I guess John wasn't real happy about being told that he committed a contradiction. But I didn't follow his explanation that he wasn't contradicting himself. He said, I'll tell you exactly how far the arguments go. There are four possible arguments, and then I wrote down the numbers, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Maybe you did too, but you can't figure out what they are. That is a bit of a problem. Because his general strategy has been to say, all I have to do is look at what Guyvet offers as evidence for God's existence and show why that doesn't have to be accepted, because there might well be other possibilities. He's not clear on what those other possibilities really are. He makes vague references to what they are. But until we know exactly what they are, we don't know if they're coherent. We don't know their mechanism. He wants to say, well, look, how is God supposed to create a physical universe? If he's immaterial and timeless, how's God supposed to do that? Well, I'm sure that Guyvet will say, it's all a mystery. And yet he says, why can't it be some kind of a natural thing, a natural object that does it? Well, that sounds like almost like scientific mysticism. But it's more mysticism than science. Because all he's doing is asking a question. He doesn't describe any kind of mechanism according to which something that's completely causally discontinuous with the physical universe could cause the physical universe. You see, other physical things, the physical stuff, would have to be physically continuous, right, in terms of the laws of nature, to cause the beginning of the universe, but then it wouldn't be the first event in the history of the universe. So he's completely misunderstood why some kind of transcendent cause, radically different kind of cause, is required here. His explanation for I guess it's supposed to be an explanation for all four of the problems that I raised about morality is education. You know, I'm just thankful that I got educated in a civilized part of the world where now I know the content of morality. Okay, so you got it from your parents. Where did they get it from? Well, they got it from their parents. Well, okay, where did they get it from? And how far back do you go before you realize there's a more fundamental question, and that is, how do human beings ultimately know what is morally right and morally wrong? And if you want to say, well, it's simply whatever fosters our survival as a community, and if we disagree, we're going to have to take a vote here. Then morality can shift and change according to the whims of social conditions. And I don't want to live in a world like that, even if we end up living in a world like that. The view of morality that I'm referring to says that there are objective moral truths that exist transcendently, and they are inviolable without consequences. But on his view, the only consequences that happen are if you get caught and people don't want you doing it. Now, He wanted me to give an example of a moral truth that is universally accepted. Well, maybe I can't. But he sure got worked up about some things like Down syndrome and things like that that he thought would be absolutely morally wrong for God to permit. So he gave the examples himself. It's not hard to come up with examples. Killing an innocent human being in cold blood. How's that for an example? Now, I can well understand why he personally would choose to create a different world if he had divine power. But he cannot stand up here and presume to know what he would do if he had God's knowledge. He has global wisdom. God has infinite wisdom, transcendent wisdom. And if we have good reason to believe that there's a God, independent of the skepticism we must have about what certain sorts of purposes certain evils serve, then we might well God may well be worthy of our worship because he promises to do something about the problem. I haven't made a big deal out of the fact that I'm a Christian here tonight, but in my closing comments, I think because of the challenge that John has issued, I will describe the way in which it seems to me God has responded to the suffering in the world precisely as I or any agnostic or atheist would expect. Thank you.
Well, I've clearly explained what flavor of atheism I prefer and how I do my skepticism. While Doug continues his education in how to be a skeptic, I'm going to plunge on and answer some specific points that he raises. Doug likes to talk about my position. He really doesn't like to talk about his own. He has still not accepted my offer to explain how the available evidence demands a supernatural hypothesis when naturalism can conservatively do the job. He has not offered any clear account of how divine creation can occur. Why he has complaints about naturalistic causality, I have no idea. He's pretty confident that the lights go on when he flicks the switch. What knowledge we have of how something could come from nothing just because God issues a command, you know? Well, you know, we've been hearing the fairy tales for a while. It doesn't mean it's becoming comprehensible to human intelligence. Doug won't explain how any evils are actually good. He doesn't like my list. He won't give us his. He doesn't want to talk about the evidence. I warned you, he wouldn't. The theologians don't. They have to have everything that absolutely happens in the world, aside from free will, and I'm going to get to that point next. He's got to have all of the stuff, all this natural design structure and the imperfections, the way God wanted it. Again, if we're talking about a God of certain perfections, and since Doug has talked about how he's a Christian, perhaps that's the God Doug's talking about. At any rate, again, we have no story here about how horrible evils, natural evils, are somehow intrinsically necessary, that God could not have reduced the number of tsunamis or hurricanes by even one in the history of the planet, could not have done without even one horrible afflictive disease that strikes us and other life forms on this planet. Why life, in short, has to be pretty hard. Now, I don't have a problem with adults having a hard life, as long as they're given a good opportunity to try to struggle along. I'm not asking for utopia, and I don't think I would live in any heaven that I've ever heard out of a Christian's mouth. But I'll tell you this, the available evidence points in the direction of only nature, because my naturalistic hypothesis is the best fit with what we actually see going on around us. We evolved on this planet, we accordingly suffer and die. I'm going to talk a little bit now about free will. My time is running out. I don't believe in any fancy philosophical free will that can suddenly hold in abeyance the universe's laws and suddenly allow a human being to shift direction. I don't believe in, it's a term of art, contra-causal free will, this sort of free will that can disobey all natural laws. But notice this, if there was such a free will that can just arbitrarily decide, shift one way or another, how would we still be able to use natural laws to get the things that we have to do done? We wouldn't be able to count on natural laws. Would you want to live in a crowd where somebody could all of a sudden suspend natural laws and do something to themselves or to you? Furthermore, the kind of free will that is being discussed here, remember, is the kind of free will that just suddenly suspends the past and shoots off in a different direction for some reason. Is that the kind of responsibility that ethics demands? Or do we act on whim? Do we suddenly cease to be good creatures of moral habits? Is that how ethical responsibility works? I think instead the notion of free will the theologian is chasing abandons and abolishes the sort of firm ethical responsibility and moral habits that we expect of adults. Finally, where do we get those? He doesn't like my answer of education. Presumably, then, he doesn't like the answer of religious education. That would be a surprise to many Christians. He would go back to God. Well, if God's on the hotline to Doug, I'm sure he can tell us all about it. For me, I'm skeptical, because if Doug thinks that God is the direct source, then he's already assuming God's existence. A funny begging of the question for somebody who told us he was not going to beg the question and instead argue from available evidence. I'll grant him that he knows and believes objective moral truths. In fact, I suspect because we are civilized people, our lists would mostly agree on all important points, I think. Maybe not. But at any rate, my point instead is that the available evidence is a planet of vast moral disagreement, gradual convergence among civilized peoples on very important moral principles, and I don't think any religion or any single human being with a hotline to God or a special scripture is going to suddenly tell the rest of humanity, you're wrong and I'm right. If Doug thinks that he's wrong and billions of people are wrong, his heaven may be sparsely inhabited indeed, but I would not join him there. Thank you.
Eddie, do you have closing statements?
Is there five closing?
Yeah.
Five more closing. Five each of closing.
One more time.
If you're up for it, Eddie, we're up for it. You up for it, Doug? I think we can do it.
Okay.
And then, questions.
So, yeah, this is the final phase, and then we go to your questions where you get to get involved in the debate with us. Look forward to hearing from you. There's a very strange thing going on here. It can seem to you probably like we're talking past each other. He's saying Doug doesn't get my argument. I want to say he doesn't get my argument because I'm saying, well, look, I've explained these phenomena. What's your explanation? And he wants to say, well, I don't like your explanation and I don't think I need your explanation. But then he doesn't really tell us what explanation works better. Let's talk about the education point when it comes to morality. Did you notice that he didn't really answer my challenge? I said, what is the ultimate source of our knowledge of the content of morality? It can't be just education. It's got to come from somewhere before that. I asked him, so what is that? No answer. So what did he say instead? Well, if Guyva doesn't like education as the source of moral knowledge, then presumably he doesn't like moral education as a source of moral knowledge. I'm not saying that education is not a source of knowledge in the realm of morality and other things. I'm talking about its ultimacy. What is the ultimate source that we turn to? How is it that we know these abstract moral truths to be true, whether or not we are educated? Now, the second thing that he accused me of was thinking that I had a hotline to God. I don't think you can find, rewind the tape, you won't hear me saying anything that has that implication. It's a fallacy to charge me with making that kind of inference. That is a serious logical error, to charge your opponent with making an inference that he didn't make. What I said was not that I get my knowledge of morality directly from God, but was that I have a faculty for knowing the content of morality, which works in this abstract, God-independent realm. And it seems to me that if I'm going to have a faculty like that, there's got to be something that explains my having that faculty. And I believe that the theistic hypothesis explains that. That's not the same thing as saying I get my moral knowledge from what I hear God saying inside my head. So that is a serious, a grave mistake. And I'm very surprised that it was made. He did go ahead and insist that he could tell us what God would be like if he was God, I'm still skeptical. He also, there is another fallacy that he's committed. He won't like this either, I'm sure. A fallacy is an egregious crime against logic. But he suggested that my view requires that I be able to explain exactly and absolutely what it is that justifies God's permission of the horrendous evils in the world. And then he said, now I know what he's going to do. He's going to have to say it's a mystery. Well, the fact is, I don't have to explain that. He hasn't shown that I have to explain it. On what basis does anybody who believes in God have to explain what God's reason are for permitting the evils that he permits? He hasn't given us that argument, and yet he gave us the conclusion. He's very good at giving us conclusions, but not so good at giving us the reasons for them. Now look, I acknowledge that one of the reasons why it's difficult to acknowledge God, to regard God as worthy of worship, and in some cases even believe in God, is that we are surrounded by mystery and difficulties explaining things that go on around us, and in particular the pain and suffering that exists. All of these fall under the description of the human condition. Now, I think what this means is that with the evidence that God exists and with the evidence of the plight of the human condition, we do have reason to expect that this God is good and would do something about the human condition. Now, this, I think, is where we get into comparative religions. But in my study of comparative religions, I find that Christianity provides not only the most engaging and interesting view of how God has produced a solution to the human condition, but one that is substantiated by special historical evidence, such as the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So you see, we have further evidence for theism if theism predicts something like a solution to the human condition embodied in Christianity, and then we have independent evidence for Christianity. That's how confirmation theory works, and I commend it all to you. Thank you.
I think I've done a pretty thorough job explaining why the available evidence is far better supportive for naturalism than for supernaturalism. There's simply no need for the utter mysteries of the God hypothesis, and we've amply heard Doug appeal to a wide variety of them. For example, he says he doesn't have to account for the natural evils, the imperfections, the bad design. Sorry, bad design means either bad design or no design. My naturalism is the conservative, skeptical result that is far better supported by the available evidence. He just admitted he can't, he won't. He says, leave it in the mystery of God's mind, he says. Ah, mysteries, mystery monging, fairy tales. The ultimate source of our knowledge of morality, I continue to claim on the naturalistic hypothesis, is that cultured peoples gradually over the centuries have strived together to live in cooperation when we've done it intelligently and with the human spirit of sympathy and cooperation. All of these things are perfectly natural, and in fact, recent Darwinian evolutionary explorations of human psychology, sociology, and anthropology far better support the notion that human beings would discover such moralities. I do not claim perfections the way Doug is looking for perfections. I claim, in fact, that naturalism would result in the actual evidence that we do see. And that's the basis for this debate. The actual evidence that we do see is a global cacophony of a wide variety of views about this and that moral point, the religions disagreeing against each other, disagreements within religions. But I do sense, and I hope you do too, that the cultured and civilized peoples of the world can find basis for mutual cooperation, can search their wisdom traditions for commonalities. We are, after all, one human species trying to live on a fragile and delicate planet. Doug says, okay, I'll bring up Christianity. That's fine. I don't doubt that he believes that he has connection with the sort of moral truths that can guide a human being steadily through the course of a life. I'm such a person. I hope you are too. We will have our disagreements. But bringing in a supernatural God abandons ethical responsibility. And this is my final point. To bow down in obedience to some God instead of consulting other human beings in a reasonable discourse, I think is the abandonment of ethical responsibility, not its discovery. I would turn the mind on when it comes to morality, not turn the mind off. If we could find out directly from God how to be moral, that would be marvelous. Why hasn't God turned on this marvelous faculty for all of us, just special people, maybe special people like Doug? There's no good explanation why a God that could care for all of the creatures of creation would somehow disable or not provide such a marvelous faculty. If there were a God, maybe I'd want one of these things. I doubt Radio Shack has got them, though. So we're going to have to bumble along as best we can, and that is called the human condition, and religious believers, notwithstanding, are in that same condition. Finally, yes, there are many mysteries. Many, many mysteries. Science does not have all the answers. Science may never have all the answers. I've argued for the conservative position that so far as we know, nature exists and natural explanations best fit the available evidence. But I'll tell you this, no matter what yearning for the human heart may tell us, putting a happy face on the deep dark mysteries that surround the fragile light of human knowledge is the abandonment of reason and responsibility. Thank you very much. I'm happy to go as long as we're getting sensible questions. We'll see how it goes.
We'll see as long as there's audience.
It may peter out, but we can see how it goes.
Both of our debaters will be answering from their chairs because to keep popping up and down for 2-minute segments would look a little comedic for such a serious topic. So again, we will ask you to ask a question and not make a statement. And then the person to whom the question is addressed will first respond for a maximum of 2 minutes. And then the opponent will respond for a maximum of 2 minutes.
Well, actually, this is pointed to both speakers. Evolution points in the direction that hunter-gatherers found cooperation as more successful to survival than competition. And this morality arose naturally. If belief in God and an imposed morality is necessary, why is it that the million people imprisoned in the United States are God believers in less than a fraction of 1% of the inhabitants are atheists? Of course, it could be that atheists are so brilliant that they can't be caught. But otherwise, I'd like an answer to the question. Thank you.
Would you like to take
that? Well, that doesn't sound like a question at all to me. It sounds like a statement. It sounds like a statement wrapped in a question. So you made your statement. My view is that there's a greater question, and that is, so why are there hunters and gatherers in the first place? Why are there creatures, critters like ourselves, who are interested in working together, even if it is for the sake of mutual survival? Why does that matter to us? It's different than it is in the animal kingdom. What's the difference, and what explains it? I didn't say that there was some moral law that was imposed from on high. These are caricatures of my view. It's in the same spirit in which John has caricatured my view, where he'll say, I'm sure Guyve at this and I'm sure Guyve at that. But I don't say those things. What I'm saying is that there are objective moral truths. We have access to them. You don't have to be a theist to know them. You can be an atheist and find them out too. And yes, we can come together and compare notes and formulate them into moral theories and agree or disagree about specific things that we say about these things. That is how we do it. But ultimately, these are transcendent truths that we come to know. What is their status, and why do they have that status? There aren't supposed to be non-natural things at all on a naturalistic view of the world. Moral facts are just that. Now, I don't even know if your facts are right. I haven't looked into it. I have no interest in the question, are they theists or not who happen to be in prison? I'm not even really interested in what they claim. If they're in prison, I'm not sure I should believe anything they say. So that doesn't sound like very interesting sociology to me.
I concur with Doug that looking at prison statistics is not an intelligent way to decide whether or not God exists or whether or not religious ethics is smarter than naturalistic ethics. I think that to return to where Doug wanted to go, I can only briefly say that we continue to hear this word transcendence because he doesn't like the word natural. Giving a naturalistic explanation of how human beings come to intelligently decide how best to cooperate is a very long story, but I'm content to let the several social and natural sciences give it their best shot before I resort to an all-knowing, all-powerful, allegedly good God that seems to be giving contradictory instructions. But I'll forbear. That's a long story. Could not be told here. Please, go ahead with your next question.
Regarding moral truth, you say that you don't have to be a theist to be able to understand transcendent moral truths, as you say. When I look at my own experience, it seems to be pretty simple to me. Moral truth for me is born from my experience as a human being, and that I would basically attribute it to the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I know what it is for me to be able to live a satisfying and a happy life. I would like to be able to act in such a way that other people enjoy that same thing. I think that would explain every moral decision that you would have to make. I don't understand why you don't agree with that and exactly how you come to understand what moral truth is.
Okay. Was that a question addressed more?
It basically is yes to Mr. Quebec.
Because it's something I said a moment ago. Well, look, I don't disagree, actually. With you. I don't think there's anything you said that I can think of that I disagree with. I accept the golden rule myself. And I think it's widely accepted. In fact, there's good evidence that it's accepted across the framework of world religions. The great world religions do teach something like that across the board. And as I said before, you wouldn't have to believe any of those, and you could still accept the golden rule. But the question is, why should you? Where does the principle come from? What is the force of that principle? Is it just accidental? Is it just something that's sort of hardwired into our DNA, and it's just sort of unavoidable that most of us will feel that way? Or is it just evolved and maybe it'll change? Or is there something really ultimate about it so that if you disagree with it, you're morally wrong? I believe the latter. And I believe that then places the content of morality, including the golden rule, in a transcendent realm that requires us to have a special faculty of moral intuition, or we wouldn't be able to know it at all. You want to follow up?
Can I maybe just...
I don't know if we're allowing that.
We're not going to have follow-up questions because we want each speaker to have 2 minutes to answer each question. If someone wants a follow-up, then they should get back in line because this way everybody will get to ask a question. That would be the most fair way of doing it.
Let me briefly just supplement Doug's remarks. I do believe that there is a force, an intelligent force, behind moral truths, if you like to call them, objective moral truths. I call it the collective practical wisdom of humanity, and I go against that grain of long traditional wisdom at my peril. So I do think that there is an intelligent force, and I'm happy to side with humanity. And that's enough evidence. We don't need an additional supernatural hypothesis, in my view, for reasons I've explained. Was there a next questioner, please?
It sounded to me like every argument has to be closer, sorry. It sounded to me like that every argument for the existence of a transcendent cause was based on the principle you stated at the very beginning that everything has a cause.
No, I didn't.
Oh, you remember what you said?
Yes, I remember very well what I said.
Could you tell me again?
I said that everything that is an event or begins to exist has a cause.
Fine.
Not the same thing.
Not quite the same thing, I agree. I was flabbergasted by this. It was pointed out years ago by Mario Bunga, among others, that science, when an area of science gets good enough, people stop asking for causes. Yeah. That is the sign of an immaturity of the science. A non-deterministic theory like quantum theory must allow a lot of uncaused events. I mean, I was just flabbergasted that somebody is still advancing the position that everything exists as a cause.
Well, let me remind you, it's everything that begins to exist as a cause, and I believe that the quanta in quantum events themselves begin to exist, so they have causes, all right? The particles themselves would not exist without being brought into existence.
By whom? Because
well,
theory does not...
Excuse me, sir, in order for this not to be disruptive, we can't have a questioner interrupt the speaker. Each speaker has 2 minutes to answer each question. You've asked your question, you have to then let someone else answer and not interrupt any debater when they respond. So each debater gets 2 minutes to answer each question, and the questioner does not get a chance to participate in a debate.
Okay, so shall I continue?
Yeah, why don't we start?
Oh, I don't need to do that. What I would go on to say is I'm perfectly familiar with this objection. I've thought about it extensively. I've talked to people like Steven Weinberg and others. And there's actually controversy among scientists about what to say about causation at the quantum level. They don't all agree that there are quantum events without causes. I think whether you agree with that or not, you're going to have causal preconditions for the behavior of quantum phenomena. So whether something behaves as a wave or a particle under observation may be indeterminate, but it's still going to be caused, in that causal preconditions have to be in place or neither one will happen. And so those events are causally conditioned, and so must the origin of the universe be.
I don't really have much to add. We are obviously at the edges of speculative and cutting-edge science, and I think perhaps Doug and I would simply await further verified and confirmed scientific theories before we confidently go any farther. That would be my take on it.
In a paper by J. Richard Gott, "Can the Universe Be Its Own Mother?" I believe is what it's called. He basically explores the physics of time travel a little bit with respect to the beginning of the universe, and if a small loop at the beginning of the universe would allow it to be possible that you can have a chain of events that there is no first event, but yet everything is caused. Basically, A causes B, causes C, causes D, which caused both A and E. So, basically, what do you think about that idea?
What's his name again?
J. Richard Gott.
Uh-huh. Well, if he had been there and back, that would be of interest. It's obviously a highly speculative thesis that maybe only one person actually is entertaining. It would surprise me if he actually believed it, because he wouldn't have much in the way of evidence for it. That's all I can say.
But there have been other cosmologists that have similarly tried to avoid the problem of something like a time zero, a T-point, that would give this sort of theological argument traction to argue that there was a definite beginning in time. These, again, to repeat, are highly speculative, and I think we must await what I hope to be powerful discoveries in the future.
I'm taking it back to the moral point, and I think it's fair to say that most theists agree that morals are somehow dictated or given to us by a god, you included. So my question is, why do we exclude God himself from those morals that he supposedly gives to us? Because I believe you'll agree that the morals we have would say genocide's wrong, torture's wrong, gnashing of teeth is wrong, fire is wrong. Yet you're a Christian, and in the Bible, God explicitly does these things himself. So is God a hypocrite, or...
Well, yeah, he's a hypocrite. Is that what you want me to say? Of course he's not a hypocrite. God is morally, essentially good. All right? So he does abide by whatever principles of morality apply to the transcendent personal being that God is. All right? Now, he creates a physical universe with contingent beings such as ourselves, and a world in which the laws of nature function as they do. We don't understand why he thinks it's permissible for some of these atrocities, as we naturally call them, to occur. We don't understand that. But we might if we were God. Now he must say, you can't appeal to mystery. I say, well, why not? Consider this. There are a number of things that have happened historically that are horrendous. But there are things that would not have happened if those things had not happened. There are tsunamis, for example, that occur, and then subsequently good things happen. Good things that would not have happened. People come to exist that never would have existed. Maybe it's good that they should exist. Now, you and I can only contemplate possibilities. We don't know what the world would have been like without the tsunami. We can believe that it would have been a better world, but we don't know that. Maybe it's a better world because of the tsunami. He says, I would like it if there was at least one less tsunami. Well, how do we know the world God created is the world with precisely one less tsunami than would be justified? We don't know that. World War II was a horrific event, many events. But how many people would be sitting here tonight if it hadn't happened?
Just very quickly, I don't want to benefit, and I would gladly give up my life if all those millions didn't have to die. I am not grateful, and God can't make me grateful.
Fair enough.
Am I next?
I think so.
I've been working on a documentary on spirituality for the past couple of years going around the world, and I'm not trying to shoot down or support either side, but in my attempt to be open-minded on this origins question, I've come across some interesting things, and this is kind of something I'm more interested in hearing the answer than making some pontificating statement. But one of the first things was maybe within the last year, read in the New York Times, there's an emerging cosmological theory that goes from bang to bust, which fits more closely to the Hindu worldview. Apparently this cosmologist is in line possibly for a Nobel Prize. I find that very interesting, the idea that there is no singularity, there is no big bang, it's a constant expansion and collapse. Based on that, my first question is, great, what happened before that? And if we get out of the time question, well, it has to begin somewhere. We're stuck in time, so somebody help me out with figuring that. My second comment was, pardon my little note phone here, was there's also some emerging evidence on biochemistry, brain chemistry, and duration of people who meditate and people who pray. Limited data coming in, but there's been some brain studies on people who spend extended time in prayer at least 2 hours a day or in meditation at least 2 hours a day seem to have experiences in sections of the brain that are relevant to selfless consciousness. My curiosity here is that sounds very interesting to dehumanize our existence to a bunch of chemicals. So I don't know if I said too much, but if each of you could just comment briefly on both, I'd be interested to hear what you think.
Perhaps I could take the honors this time. Your first question was about the oscillating universe. Again, speculative. I look forward to, you know, cosmologists seeing if they can converge on a theory that best fits fresh evidence. On the business of the study of spirituality through brain states, on the naturalistic hypothesis, it is much easier to explain how rich experiences, both aesthetically of beauty and wonder of the world around us, and also the joys, perhaps blisses, of internal meditation, these are all connected to the brain. In other words, on the naturalistic hypothesis, you would expect to see brain changes where there are mental changes. A dramatic scientific discovery that, in fact, mind can float free from body would be evidence of dramatic mental changes where absolutely no significant brain changes can be detected by science. That has not yet happened, right? That evidence has not yet come forth. So I think the balance of evidence points toward the naturalistic claim that mind and body are deeply connected, and then there are various flavors of naturalism that can explain why and how that can happen, complexities that are perhaps inappropriate here. But that's all I had to say about those two points.
The general point about consciousness is very interesting. I could have included it in my argument. It's not true that affirming a deep connection between the mental and the brain is naturalistic. That's an assumption that naturalists make, but then they have to say more than that. They have to say that either the mental and the physical are identical, or they have to believe that the mental supervene on or somehow occur because of the physical, but there's no causation from the mental to the physical. Most naturalists would deny that. So they hold to an identity theory of mind and body, or they hold to an epiphenomenalist theory. But this concerns a problem in philosophy that's called the explanatory gap problem, and that is the problem of trying to explain the gap between conscious experiences and physical states in the brain. It doesn't even have to be about prayer or meditation. It can be looking at an object of the color blue, and you see blue, and you have this consciousness of this color. He said that we don't have any evidence of minds floating free of bodies, but on his view, what could count as evidence? What could count as evidence of minds floating as bodies, on his view? Thankfully, our bodies are connected with minds, and it is with our minds that we do things with our bodies. I didn't get into anything about how an non-physical being like God could perform physical acts, but we are, I believe, immaterial souls that have bodies. And we do it ourselves as finite creatures. We have intentions that come from our minds, and we're able to raise our arms if we will, and have the power to do it, and so forth. So consciousness is itself a serious problem for naturalism, and easier to explain on a theistic view where God is the ultimate mind.
So far in this debate, I've not seen either of you insult each other with petty names. I've never seen you strike each other in anger. I've never seen you commit murder. And I believe that both of you have had your opinions for more than a year, more than five, more than 10. So it seems that whether or not you believe God exists doesn't change your actions. And if I can make an assumption, I'm pretty sure that both of you know at least one person who has died, right? So it seems that whether or not you believe in God doesn't change what's going to happen to you or those around you. So what I wonder is, whether or not you believe in God, if we can prove that he, she, it exists or doesn't, what bearing does it have on our own lives?
I'd be really wrong, and I'd have to tell everybody so. If it could be proven that these arguments actually provide far weightier evidence than any naturalistic explanation, I would be very intrigued by what else religion has to say. My course hasn't been one of steady dogmatic assertion, but rather a gradual, interesting intellectual path where I started out knowing, as most college freshmen do, not much about science and certainly not much about the complexities and varieties of naturalism, and there are varieties. There are more, perhaps not as popular today, than those that Doug mentioned, but there are. And there are lots more to learn about human morality and how human beings can intelligently work together to improve our moralities. We've been at this a long time. If you will, if it needs a name, it might be called ethical thinking. Great religions do a great deal of ethical thinking. It's not a coincidence that Jesus, Buddha, Confucius, the list could go on, are exceedingly concerned with getting large groups of people to converge on very important ethical principles so that we can solve the problems of civilizations on this planet. And this process continues, and I'd like to be a part of it.
Well, believing a proposition is not going to determine whether or not there is such a thing as immortality, for example. But if you believe in immortality and you're right, well then, you'll experience immortality. There may be conditions for experiencing immortality of one form or another. And that could have a lot to do with the way you live your life in the present time. So I do think that whether you believe in God, what you believe about God, and how serious you are in believing about God in terms of living your life can make a huge difference to the way you live and the way you raise your children and the way you relate to other people and the way you prepare yourself for the afterlife that you think is coming. It would be quite different for me, I should say, if I didn't believe that. So, yes, I think it's a deadly serious issue if it turns out that the conviction, the commitments we make morally and ethically and related to God make a difference to our eternal destiny.
I have heard a hypothesis that some people have said that nothing is unstable, and I think nothing is a kind of incomprehensible as infinity, which where we'd have nothing. And so some people have put forward the theory that if, when you start with nothing, that the laws of probability and the laws of math demand that all possibilities, all possible universe would come into being. Now, you can comment on that any way you want to, but one aspect I would like to see both of you deal with, if the laws of math are responsible for bringing, and laws of probability are responsible for bringing everything into existence, would that be defined as a transcendent cause? Or would that be defined as a naturalistic cause?
There's a bit of ambiguity in the question, so I'm unsure how to answer, but I think I will answer it, and you can pass the microphone to the next person. When you speak of these mathematical laws or probabilistic laws, the word law can be a bit ambiguous. It might refer to some sort of regular habit of energy transformation or some physical constant that's continually obeyed. Or it might mean a law in the purely mathematical sense, where you're talking about relationships between mathematical entities that do not themselves exist. In the second sense, I'm not sure that purely mathematical entities, laws, relationships, equations, could produce anything physical. There's a dramatic gap of the sort that I've claimed exists between a supernatural divinity and a physical universe. If, however, you meant laws about things, energies, powers, forces, what have you, that are responsible for creation, then we're simply sort of talking about using nature to explain more nature, and I think we've already sort of adequately debated the merits and demerits of that approach, although I could be wrong. Doug, you might.
Well, it does sound to me like when you raise the notion of nothingness, and say that there are some who think of that as something that's unstable, then you're talking about the view that there is something there, and then mathematics and logic somehow work such that you can get all kinds of possibilities and maybe several at the same time. Is that sort of the view? Okay. Well, then it sounds to me like these probabilistic laws are laws of logic, but they're not operating on anything physical or concrete, and the laws themselves are causally inert. They don't make things happen. They're just too abstract. And I agree with John that the mathematical relations would be the same. You relate two numbers using an operator like the plus sign, and you get 2 plus 2 equals 4. But there isn't a 2 and a 2 and an operator and a 4 necessarily. But if there are, now some people believe that numbers exist. But even those who believe that they exist believe that they're abstract objects and therefore causally inert. So they're not going to make anything happen either. My view is that nothing is nothing, and that there's nothing about nothing that gives it content.
Hi, my name is Bob. I'm a non-believer, used to be a believer. The longer I stood in this line, the stupider my questions seemed to be. What time is it? No, that's not the question.
That's probably a good question.
I guess I was thinking, what if I was this life form that came from another planet? I go to this debate where they're talking about, does God exist? First thing I want to know is, what is God? What is God, other than a word? What is God?
Well, I told you what I meant by God without using the word God. I gave a description, and then I said, this is what I mean by God, and I'm going to use that word for that description, right? A timeless, immaterial or spaceless, personal being of great power and intelligence who created the universe and sustains it in existence. That's a pretty elaborate description to which the term God refers in the context that I'm using it here tonight. Now, your ETI is an interesting case. I don't know why we assume that extraterrestrial intelligences wouldn't come to us and say, good grief, you don't believe in God? We've always believed in God.
Please, next question.
In your first statement, one of your major arguments seems to be that the universe seems to be designed to suit human beings. And since you're a sophisticated theologian, I assume that you accept the theory of evolution in which we would adapt to our environment. And from a solipsistic viewpoint, I can see how that would look like the universe was designed for us. But since we came after the universe, why wouldn't we be simply adapting to it?
Okay. Well, I'm not a theologian, all right? My theologian friends would probably want me to emphasize that. Okay. No, my field is philosophy. But what I want to say is, well, look, evolution doesn't really have to enter into this discussion. And it hasn't. I guess you noticed that it hasn't really entered into the discussion all that much. First life is something that comes much later in geological history and the interaction of chemicals in the physical universe. So if there is reason to believe that God exists because there's an origin of the universe, there's apparent design that would not be as well explained otherwise, first life itself has not yet been explained. There is no really compelling theory that's got scientists really excited right now about how life began. I was in the Natural History Museum, I guess it is, in New York City. And there was a spiral walkway showing the history of the physical universe from the Big Bang up to the present time. And I said to my daughter, let's see what it says about where they mark off the origin of life. We looked there and it said, somehow life began at this time. Somehow. That's pretty much where we are still today. I think God is a good explanation for that. Now, what happened later? I don't know. Consciousness itself is something peculiar to the physical universe. So certainly, if we exist, and God intended this universe to have the properties that it does, and we wouldn't otherwise exist, then there is reason to think that we matter to God. And so there's nothing solipsistic about it. It's not even selfish. And then if God condescends to reveal himself in special ways, then we have even better reason to think that he cares.
Doug is quite right that a complete theory of the origin of the first self-replicating organic molecules on the planet is not yet confirmed by, you know, any confident body of scientists. However, it's a bad bet to bet against science. There was a time not so long ago when every volcano required a god to cause it. Yes, there are mysteries that remain in the universe, but already even life is starting to succumb to the various sciences. Scientists are recently discovering how given simple, simplest organic molecules that would have been here on the Earth anyway can actually start to assemble under, again I stress, conditions that we were fairly confident existed. This is not anything like a complete theory, but we continue to see the forward-marching progress of science that is driving the God hypothesis right out of the natural world and is still lingering on the dark fringes and edges of human knowledge. Please, next question.
As a non-religious, fundamental Christian, I gather my strength and my beliefs through Scripture. And this question is directed to John. John, how is it that prophecy in Scripture and the fulfillment of that prophecy at later dates in Scripture, how is that explained from your world perspective?
There have been no successful serious prophecies in Scripture or anywhere else. Alleged prophecies, for example, citing Old Testament sources that are allegedly about New Testament events, are highly interpreted, dubious translations from the Hebrew, and interestingly, always invented hundreds of years after Christianity had already consolidated itself. For example, this business of resorting to mention of Emmanuel, you know. The word Emmanuel actually isn't in any of the three synoptic gospels. This is later Christians trying to show desperately some connection between the Old Testament God and the New Testament God and stretching translation and credibility to try to find a few highly suspected, suspicious, alleged prophecies. I'm not confident that there's any solid evidence of serious scriptural prophecy. One last point. If God had really wanted to use Scripture, had really wanted to use prophets to really prove something impressive, where's the line in the Old Testament that says the moon has craters? Where's the old line in the Old Testament that says Jupiter has moons? Where's the line in the Old Testament that says you can take simple compounds and create clear glass? God had plenty of opportunities to make some serious prophecies that could be verified. We don't see them. Instead, we see a collection of interesting stories that is easily explained entirely in terms of the cultural traditions. Nothing supernatural here required.
Well, an interesting final point. Several things. The Old Testament scriptures do refer to the circumference of the earth. There are some other things that are of interest. There are archaeological findings, civilizations referred to in the Old Testament that weren't known, like the Hittite civilization that was not known to exist. That's not prophecy, but it shows that there are sciences, even in their new development, that are corroborating some of the things that aren't in the scriptures. But I think it's more important to notice this. First of all, even if you couldn't prove that a prophetic claim was fulfilled by a certain statement, it wouldn't follow that that is not a fulfillment of the prophetic claim. In other words, a prophet could prophesy. Something could happen that does fit the description, and the skeptic could say, yeah, but that could have just happened. Fine, but it also could have been fulfillment of prophecy. That's one thing. So you can't just automatically throw prophecy out as something that happens just because you can't confirm that it did happen in that case. Second, I think we should be wary of using prophecy and alleged fulfillments of prophecy as a hard-boiled defense of the authority of Scripture, simply because there are only limited cases where it is going to be possible to really produce the right kinds of strict guidelines. The one that interests me the most is written about in a book that I co-edited. I did not write the chapter. I don't have the qualifications to. But in a book that I edited called In Defense of Miracles, there's a chapter on prophecy by Robert Newman. And I would encourage anybody here, the questioner, for example, interested in this question, maybe take a look at that chapter. Maybe John should take a look at that chapter. It'd be interesting to see if he thought that maybe there is more to that particular instance of prophecy than he believes. But again, the main thing here is that you can't deny that prophecies occurred simply because you can't confirm that something was the fulfillment of a prophecy.
I'm actually going to change my question. You had mentioned the Hittites.
Yeah.
So the Hittites were one of the seven nations in the Bible who were inhabitants of Canaan who were marked for genocide. They were one of the seven, along with the Canaanites and others, that the ancient Israelites were commanded to destroy, and it went into substantial detail in how to destroy. Mm-hmm. Men, women, children, cattle, property, art, etc. I use that as an example to ask, you had made in your argument that altruism could not have occurred or unlikely to have occurred naturally, and the faculties that we had, our moral inclinations, are probably godly derived. But then when you actually look at the Bible, and as a Christian, I assume you'd use also the Old Testament as a source of God's intention, you see not only random events like volcanoes and floods that occur where we have to say why, we also see commandments ostensibly being given by God to commit genocide and other crimes of that nature. So if we leave aside the natural tsunamis and things of that nature, could you explain how you look at the Bible as a source of relevant morality and, in essence, a reflection of God's morality in terms of how we use that body of literature as God's instruction to inform our conduct?
Yeah. Well, the first thing to note is that we've wandered from our topic, right? Our question tonight is, does God exist, and is there anything answering to the description of God that I gave in my definition? What interests me is, why is it that atheists ask questions about the Bible without being prepared to take seriously the evidence for the existence of God, whether or not the Bible is the Word of God, right? See, it may not be the Word of God. It wouldn't have to be for God to exist. And so the evidence for God's existence could be just as compelling as it is, regardless of what you make of the authority of Scripture. So we have to make that clear tonight, because that's why we're here, to talk about God and reasons to believe there is a God. Now, when it comes to this particular part of Scripture, there's no question that it is counterintuitive that we could be justified in doing that sort of thing. Now, notice this is commanded under certain conditions that aren't replicated in history, if it's commanded at all. There are actually there are conservative scholars who think that this is not a command from God, but it is construed as a command by the people themselves, mistakenly so. That's one of the views, actually. Another interpretation is that when they invoke the idea that God gave us this victory and we did His will, it's like fitting into the ethnic and cultural context among all the nations, where they would appeal to their gods as the rationale for what they did, and they'd say, you know, our team beat your team, that kind of thing, and we beat you by, you know, this huge margin when it might have been by one touchdown. So there are various interpretations that you can't. You assume.
Wait, stop. The time is up.
You assumed a particular interpretation.
Just very briefly, I'm delighted when Christians critically examine, try to carefully interpret, and selectively obey their own scripture. This supports the naturalistic hypothesis that, in fact, humanity is capable of knowing right from wrong, and that progress in morality and ethics has occurred. I doubt very few Christians today would look at various passages in the Old Testament and say, yeah, that's my Savior. No. So I think we have to be careful looking to old Scripture to accuse present-day Christians who are far more humanistic and much more like atheists than anyone was back then.
Before we take the next question, I just need to ask technically our filming people, do we need to stop to change the tape, or are we all right? Okay, keep going.
A separate practical question. May I suggest 9:30 as an absolute time stop to avoid fatiguing everyone?
Okay, what we will do then is only those in line, as we will ask no one further to line up, if that's okay.
Gentleman almost took what I was going to ask. If you look at the Bible, you look at Numbers 31, and Moses has a battle with the Midianites. His soldiers come back, and Moses says, "Did you kill the women and children?" to his generals. The generals say no, and he says, "What's wrong with you? You got to go out and kill all the children, all the male children, and all the female children who are virgins. You can spear them and distribute them." Now, and then in Deuteronomy 13 and 20, we're told that if somebody comes to your relative and says, "Don't believe in God," you should kill him. In John 15:6, it says, "If you don't accept Christ, you should be put into a fire like a burning bush." And the interesting thing about Moses is this: if he was living today, he'd be called a war criminal. But you put him in the Bible, and everybody worships him, Jews, Muslims, Christians. I have Muslim relatives who tell me, "Well, Moses wasn't really Jewish, he was really a Muslim." So couldn't we say that even if there is a natural force, the Mohammedan Jewish Christian version of it is pretty sick, as Steven Weinberg said this morning. And there are many phrases in the Quran that say the same thing.
I think you're covering similar territory as the previous gentleman, and I think my answer to that gentleman stands for yours as well. Doug might want to add some more.
No.
Next questioner, please.
I'll try again. I'm willing to, it is my suspicion that once you posit that everything that exists has a cause...
No, that's not what I said. Third time.
Say it again.
It's not everything that exists has a cause.
What did you say?
Everything that is an event or begins to exist, which is a kind of event, that has a cause.
Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Once you posit that, it is my... I suspect that you will inevitably end up with the with coming up with a transcendent God, such as a transcendent cause, such as God.
Mm.
I agree. What I wish to say is that we have many, many things that begin to exist that for which we do not know the cause. We don't have to wait for an answer from quantum mechanics. We know right now that quantum mechanics has many such things for which it does not know a cause.
Does not know a cause, or does not have a cause?
Either.
Well, that's going.
No, we don't know that it doesn't have a cause. We don't know a cause.
Well, that's
so that
different.
This is a. I want to say that this idea that everything that begins to exist have a cause is an article of faith.
Well, okay. There are a couple of ways that philosophers explain the rationale for the principle of causality that I've invoked here. One is empirically by noting that there is zero evidence for any event that does not have a cause. Okay, that's an empirical argument, and there are, I mean, I think it's a perfectly reasonable claim that if we've never observed an event that we know to have no cause, then we're within our rights to believe that events have causes. Actually, science depends upon that, and it's one reason why quantum mechanics continues to be a going concern, because in a world where there are no causes, anything can happen and for no reason at all. But there's another reason why some believe, like myself, in the principle of causation, and that is that I believe it is a basic principle of rationality that we know by means of rational intuition. There are a number of things that we know this way. I think it's in the category of something that is red all over cannot be green all over. We know that, too. But we haven't examined all the red things, to be sure. We don't have to examine all the red things to be sure that anything that's red all over is not green all over. I think it's similar that we know the principle of causation that I'm referring to in much the same way. Not empirically only, but by means of a rational intuition that we have of its truth.
I have nothing further to add. Please ask your question.
Yes. My question is in regard to the ambiguity of God, because You look around the world, there's so many different religions, too many to count. I guess my question is just, why was God so, excuse the layman, stupid to send mixed messages to people all over the earth? Because you ask anyone, even of the same religion, they'll give you a different version of what they think of God or the afterlife or whatever. So you could go into the free will argument, but I just don't see...
Listen, you're a young guy, and I'm reluctant to say this, but I do think that it's inappropriate to say stupid in a context like this.
True, absolutely.
Okay? Simply because if we're going to have an exchange of ideas, all right, we should respect each other's position, and I'm trying to do that here. Now, look... A lot of these questions have been questions like, well, if God exists, then why this and why that, and why would he think this and why would he allow that? But I can think almost anybody I know does something I can't explain. And I don't have to know. I don't know how to find out. Maybe if I ask them, they'll explain it to me. Maybe they won't be able to explain it to me because I'm too dense. I'm stupid. All right? But I just don't know why we ask questions like that so much when we haven't answered the more fundamental questions like, so what does explain the origin of the universe if it's not God? Now, once we come to the conclusion that God does exist, well, then by all means, let's go to these questions and think, okay, now if God exists... Now that we think such a thing, what are we supposed to make of this other stuff? But that kind of question doesn't really give me a reason to think there is no God.
The question of why revelations disagree, why religions make so many different claims about what God wants and what God is, and so forth and so on, again, to repeat, is more easily explained, I think, on my naturalistic hypothesis. I think far more important than looking to the cacophony of revelation, which, as a totality, it couldn't even be really called even a body of evidence either way. That's too generous. Instead, I respect the intellectual pursuit of looking at the evidence that we collectively can agree upon and then seeing what reasonable inferences can or cannot be made from there. So I guess that's sort of in general sympathy with what Doug wanted to say about our methods tonight.
One final question. Question.
My question is, I heard John say earlier in his talk that he has a certain humility with which he looks at science and his studies of naturalism and so forth. And I presume, Doug, you would have the same kind of humility as you look at religious studies and in terms of philosophy. A couple of things. My question is going to be that there was an article in the Buffalo News about a week or two ago that said basically that one-third of all recognized scientists truly believe in God. That's the first part. And it said 83% of American people truly believe in God. As a humble scientist and as a humble religionist, do you not place some faith in those scientists who do believe in God? Are they not bright, intellectual people who have grasped and embraced a faith that takes them beyond the purely natural? And do you place any stock in scientists who have given, through their faith in Christianity, have given us the foundations of science? I'm thinking of people like Copernicus and Galileo, and people like that. And can you not, with humility, respect the science that is exegesis of scriptures, which is such a science, as well as theology being a science itself? There's so many incredible, intelligent authors who take apart the mystery of God in so many kinds of ways, and they try to challenge us to realize that no matter who we are, scientists or religionists, none of us has all the answers. So my bottom line question is, don't you have some trust and faith in the dignity and respect that should be offered to the 83% of people in the country that believe in God and those one-third scientists who also do? They are as bright and as intelligent as both of you. And don't you trust in the humanity of believing people? Are they stupid? I'll use the word stupid now. Are all those people stupid?
You are confusing intelligence with the capacity to apply that intelligence to questions that require serious specialization. Doug said he's not a theologian. I'm not a theologian. But we are discussing theological arguments that can get incredibly sophisticated and dense, and quite frankly, require such specialization. You gave another example, that of scriptural exegesis. I have enormous respect for scriptural exegesis. I wish there were more of it. It tends to lead to a very liberal, non-dogmatic, and non-literalist understanding of our religious histories. I respect that. What I do not respect is somehow somebody saying, just because somebody is smart in one area, that they're a know-it-all in all other areas. That is an unintelligent conclusion. It's an argument from wrong authority, and I don't buy it. Faith is not necessarily the correct application of intelligence. I'm not saying faith is unintelligent. I await really good, intelligent explanations for faith. If I heard them, I would not be an atheist. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. This whole debate is an invitation to consider the arguments on their merits. Scientists have that opportunity. You have that opportunity. What I do not respect is somebody saying, my faith comes first, and then I'm going to go look for the evidence and interpretation that backs up my prior faith. That I will never respect, and I suspect that anybody who tries to pull that on you is not respecting your intelligence either.
John, I don't think our guest said that these were know-it-all people or thought of themselves in that way. Like, I thought he was saying something very different than that. It is impressive that there are intellectuals across the disciplines, not just the sciences. In my field, in philosophy, there has been a surge of philosophers coming into the universities who are not only theists but Christians. One of the largest societies in philosophy in North America is the Society of Christian Philosophers. And this is obviously something that atheists have to reckon with. Quentin Smith, one of our colleagues at another university, is a naturalist, an atheist. He has written an article in which he has warned naturalists that they have not prepared themselves for the surge of theistic philosophers and the powerful arguments that they have been making. That naturalists have simply been too casual because they've thought that they were the only ones controlling the ivory tower. Well, that's changing. And because that's changing, there are going to be more events just like this. So I think it is evidence of the kind of respect that you're talking about that John has invited me to come and participate in this. What does surprise me, though, is his tendency to convey the impression that there is zero evidence for the existence of God, or that it's so low it's not even considerable. And that, I think, is prima facie implausible precisely because they're intelligent people who've developed the evidence and developed the arguments. One last thing about humility. Intellectual humility is not just a matter of being skeptical. In fact, sometimes intellectual humility requires belief in something because the evidence is ample, even if you don't want to believe it.
On that note, we want to thank our debaters for putting on this marvelous discussion tonight.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
We want to thank all of you for attending, because what you heard tonight was a debate on what may truly be the most important question really facing the world today. And on behalf of the Center for Inquiry, once again, I want to thank you for your presence here tonight. Thank you.